Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today on the program, we have two stories related to the disputed waters of the South China Sea. The United States military plans to send a large portion of its ships and aircraft into the area by 2020. We will have more on that story later in the program. But first, the Philippines has launched a campaign to push for an ecotourism zone in the middle of the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea. Under the plan, tourists could visit Philippine-controlled parts of the disputed area. An American-based group called U.S. Pinoys for Good Governance proposed the idea of the ecotourism zone. The organization was set up to work for causes related to the Philippines. China, Vietnam, and Taiwan claim nearly all of the South China Sea. The Philippines, Malaysia, and Brunei have partial territorial claims. Eric Lachica is with the U.S. Pinoys for Good Governance. He says the proposed travel area would be the best way to settle the competing claims. He adds that each of the claimants has taken steps to develop islands and coral reefs in the disputed waters.
Let's protect our interests. China has 9, Philippines has 9, Malaysia has 5, Vietnam has 48. So I think to protect what they've got, this is a perfect solution. It minimizes their military headaches. At the same time, it improves their economic position.
Malaysia, Vietnam, and China all have places for tourists among the Spratlys and other islands in the South China Sea. Mr. Lachica says he thought of the plan after meeting Eugenio Pitoanan, the mayor of the Philippine-controlled Spratlys. The islands are known locally as the Calayan group of islands. Mr. Pitoanan told reporters in Manila this month that he has had this idea of tourism for peace for some time.
But in my capacity as a local government, as municipality of Calayan, that would take a long time for me to prepare to be able to really reach a level of convenience where we can bring tourists there. And without also the enabling policies at the national level, it would be difficult for me.
Eric Lachica says the best situation would be to have the Philippine Senate approve a resolution, with the president's office offering its support. Then, he says, the Philippines could make a proposal to China and the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Eugenio Pitoanan says he can imagine tourists traveling from the main island of Titu to small, nearby islands also controlled by the Philippines. He adds that a planned shelter at Titu could protect visitors during severe weather. You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. The new commander of the United States Navy's Pacific Fleet is seeking to ease concerns of U.S. allies in the area. Admiral Scott H. Swift says the pivot of American military forces to East Asia and the Pacific will continue. Yet some of the allies remain worried about China's development of islands in disputed waters. VOA correspondent Steve Herman in Bangkok is following the story. Mario Ritter has his report.
Scott Swift formerly commanded the U.S. 7th Fleet. He became the chief of the Pacific Fleet 3 months ago. Since then, he has gone to the Philippines, South Korea, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and Malaysia to meet with top Navy commanders. Admiral Swift spoke with reporters by telephone before traveling from Kuala Lumpur to Singapore. He noted what he called great angst in every place he has visited. He said this feeling resulted from the worrying scale and scope of China's land reclamation projects in the South China Sea.
All of them have expressed concerns and uncertainty about what the future may hold. But I think what's most important is to come together in a multilateral way and approach reconciling these differences in claims within the region in a positive way and not allow the use of coercion or force as a lever to resolve differences to the benefit of one party or the other.
Admiral Swift was asked about concerns among America's allies about U.S. Defense Department plans for what has been called the Pacific Pivot.
It's less a reflection of what the United States' ability is to support the refocus. It's more of a reflection of the angst in the theater. As you suggest, many in the countries are concerned about what the future is, and many of them are turning to the United States as a continued guarantor of the stability that they've enjoyed throughout the region, certainly for the last 70 years.
Last week, the U.S. Defense Department released its maritime security roadmap. The plan calls for 60% of naval and aviation assets deployed to the Asia-Pacific area by 2020. Japan will be at the center of the U.S. efforts, with Guam providing a major base. There also are to be partnerships with Vietnam and India, both considered competitors of China. And military joint operations are to be expanded with Indonesia, Japan, and Malaysia. Admiral Swift also expressed hope of expanding contacts with China's Navy and Coast Guard. The aim, he said, is to try to decrease the elements of instability that are occurring in the region. The Asia-Pacific Maritime Security Strategy Report for 2015 says China is using a steady progression of small incremental steps to increase effective control over disputed areas and avoid escalation to military conflict. China claims much of the South China Sea. Those territorial claims conflict with claims of several countries, including the Philippines and Vietnam. China blames the United States for heightening tensions in the resource-rich area, which includes one of the busiest waters for trade ships. I'm Mario Ritter.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is In the News. 10 years ago, a very powerful storm struck the southeastern United States. Hurricane Katrina brought destruction and flooding to states bordering the Gulf of Mexico. Floodwaters covered large parts of New Orleans, Louisiana. Today, much of the city's housing has been rebuilt. So have roads and other infrastructure. Businesses, trade, and visitors have returned to the area. President Barack Obama visited New Orleans on Thursday as the Gulf Coast marks the 10th anniversary of the storm. The president praised the efforts to rebuild New Orleans, but said more needs to be done.
Because of you, the people of New Orleans, working together, this city is moving in the right direction.
After 10 years, New Orleans has recovered. But it is a different city than the one before the storm. Deputy Mayor Andy Copeland voiced the feelings people have for the city.
10 years later, we're pretty proud to show off what we think is, one of the greatest renaissances of any city in history anywhere.
The city's demographics also have changed. New Orleans is, in many ways, a younger city today than it was in 2005. Mr. Copeland says that is partly because it appeals to young people with its culture, music, and food.
We have, almost 500 more restaurants in the city of New Orleans today than we had before Katrina. So we have fewer people but more restaurants.
New Orleans is different in other ways. It has improved bridges and roads. The city also has better schools than 10 years ago, and a smaller, more diverse population. Allison Plyer studies statistical changes for the data center. She says New Orleans now has about 385,000 residents.
The city has about 100,000 fewer African Americans than it did pre-Katrina. It also has about 10,000 fewer white residents. We have more Latinos and Asians than we did.
For a long time, New Orleans was a popular stop for both U.S. and foreign travelers. The destruction hurt the tourist industry for some time. Now, city officials say tourism is doing well again. Andy Copeland says New Orleans had 9.3 million visitors last year. Michael Hecht is head of Greater New Orleans, Inc. His group supports development in New Orleans and surrounding areas.
We are number one per capita in terms of in-migration of people under 25 with a college degree.
New Orleans and the state of Louisiana have benefited from federal aid. Michael Hecht says major investments from American and foreign private capital companies also have helped.
Louisiana now is number one per capita in foreign direct investments. We've had investments over the past few years from Europe, from Asia, from South America.
New Orleans began as a port near the mouth of the Mississippi River. Officials say more than ever before, the city is linked to the rest of the world. Still, the memory of the disaster remains. 1,800 people are believed to have died because of Katrina. Hundreds of thousands were displaced. Problems after the storm were blamed on lack of coordination between politicians, relief organizations, the military, and the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Craig Frugate is FEMA's current administrator. He says state and federal groups now coordinate their efforts. Mr. Frugate says building codes have been upgraded and adds that he believes the city will be able to resist another major storm. And that's In the News. I'm Mario Ritter.
Our story today is called A Horseman in the Sky. It was written by Ambrose Bierce. Here is Roy Depew with the story.
Carter Drews was born in Virginia. He loved his parents, his home, and the South. But he loved his country, too. And in the autumn of 1861, when the United States was divided by a terrible civil war, Carter Drews, a Southerner, decided to join the Union Army of the North. He told his father about his decision one morning at breakfast. The older man looked at his only son for a moment, too shocked to speak. Then he said, "As of this moment, you are a traitor to the South. Please don't tell your mother about your decision. She's sick, and we both know she has only a few weeks to live." Carter's father paused, again looking deep into his son's eyes. "Carter," he said, "no matter what happens, be sure you always do what you think is your duty." Both Carter Drews and his father left the table that morning with broken hearts. And Carter soon left his home and everyone he loved to wear the blue uniform of the Union soldier. One sunny afternoon, a few weeks later, Carter Drews lay with his face in the dirt by the side of a road. He was on his stomach, his arms still holding his gun. Carter would not receive a medal for his actions. In fact, if his commanding officer were to see him, he would order Carter shot immediately. For Carter was not dead or wounded. He was sleeping while on duty. Fortunately, no one could see him. He was hidden by some bushes growing by the side of the road. The road Carter Drews had been sent to guard was only a few miles from his father's house. It began in a forest down in the valley and climbed up the side of a huge rock. Anyone standing on the top of this high rock would be able to see down into the valley. And that person would feel very dizzy looking down. If he dropped a stone from the edge of this cliff, it would fall for 600 meters before disappearing into the forest in the valley below. Giant cliffs, like the one Carter lay on, surrounded the valley. Hidden in the valley's forest were five Union regiments, thousands of Carter's fellow soldiers. They had marched for 36 hours. Now they were resting. But at midnight, they would climb that road up the rocky cliff. Their plan was to attack by surprise an army of Southerners camped on the other side of the cliff. But if their enemy learned about the Union Army hiding in the forest, the soldiers would find themselves in a trap with no escape. That was why Carter Drews had been sent to guard the road. It was his duty to be sure that no enemy soldier, dressed in gray, spied on the valley where the Union Army was hiding. But Carter Drews had fallen asleep. Suddenly, as if a messenger of fate came to touch him on the shoulder, the young man opened his eyes. As he lifted his head, he saw a man on horseback, standing on the huge rocky cliff that looked down into the valley. The rider and his horse stood so still that they seemed made of stone. The man's gray uniform blended with the blue sky and the white clouds behind him. He held a gun in his right hand and the horse's reins in the other. Carter could not see the man's face because the rider was looking down into the valley. But the man and his horse seemed to be of heroic, almost gigantic size, standing there motionless against the sky. Carter discovered he was very much afraid, even though he knew the enemy soldier could not see him hiding in the bushes. Suddenly the horse moved, pulling back its head from the edge of the cliff. Carter was completely awake now. He raised his gun, pushing its barrel through the bushes, and he aimed for the horseman's heart. A small squeeze of the trigger, and Carter Drews would have done his duty. At that instant, the horseman turned his head and looked in Carter's direction. He seemed to look at Carter's face, into his eyes, and deep into his brave, generous heart. Carter's face became very white. His entire body began shaking. His mind began to race, and in his fantasy, the horse and rider became black figures, rising and falling in slow circles against a fiery red sky. Carter did not pull the trigger. Instead, he let go of his gun and slowly dropped his face until it rested again in the dirt. Brave and strong as he was, Carter almost fainted from the shock of what he had seen. Is it so terrible to kill an enemy who might kill you and your friends? Carter knew that this man must be shot from ambush without warning. This man must die without a moment to prepare his soul, without even the chance to say a silent prayer. Slowly, a hope began to form in Carter Drews's mind. Perhaps the Southern soldier had not seen the Northern troops. Perhaps he was only admiring the view. Perhaps he would now turn and ride carelessly away. Then Carter looked down into the valley so far below. He saw a line of men in blue uniforms and their horses slowly leaving the protection of the forest. A foolish Union officer had permitted his soldiers to bring their horses to drink at a small stream near the forest. And there they were in plain sight. Carter Drews looked back to the man and horse standing there against the sky. Again, he took aim. But this time he pointed his gun at the horse. Words rang in his head, the last words his father ever spoke to him. No matter what happens, be sure you always do what you think is your duty. Carter Drews was calm as he pulled the trigger of his gun. At that moment, a Union officer happened to look up from his hiding place near the edge of the forest. His eyes climbed to the top of the cliff that looked over the valley. Just looking at the top of the gigantic rock, so far above him, made the soldier feel dizzy. And then the officer saw something that filled his heart with horror. A man on a horse was riding down into the valley through the air. The rider sat straight in his saddle. His hair streamed back, waving in the wind. His left hand held his horse's reins, while his right hand was hidden in the cloud of the horse's mane. The horse looked as if it were galloping across the earth. Its body was proud and noble. As the frightened Union officer watched this horseman in the sky, he almost believed he was witnessing a messenger from heaven, a messenger who had come to announce the end of the world. The officer's legs grew weak, and he fell. At almost the same instant, he heard a crashing sound in the trees. The sound died without an echo, and all was silent. The officer got to his feet, still shaking. He went back to his camp, but he didn't tell anyone what he had seen. He knew no one would ever believe him. Soon after firing his gun, Carter Drews was joined by a Union sergeant. Carter did not turn his head as the sergeant kneeled beside him. "Did you fire?" the sergeant whispered. "Yes." "At what?" "A horse. It was on that rock. It's not there now. It went over the cliff." Carter's face was white, but he showed no other sign of emotion. The sergeant did not understand. "See here, Drews," he said after a moment's silence, "why are you making this into a mystery? I order you to report. Was there anyone on the horse?"
"Yes."
"Who?"
My father."
You have heard the story called A Horseman in the Sky. It was written by Ambrose Bierce and adapted for Special English by Donna DeSanctis. Your storyteller was Roy DePue.